So my name is Andrew. My last name is Strauss. And I'm not related to Levi or Johann or any of the famous Strausses that I'm aware of. I am an alcoholic, and I know that today. I did concede to my innermost self, finally. Thank God. I had my first drink when I was 8 days old, actually. It was at my bris. So for those who may not know what bris is, it's the ritual circumcision ceremony done by I was born and raised in an Orthodox Jewish family. So at that time, the moil, another favorite Seinfeld episode, the moil, the circumciser, after the slice is completed, they would put a little wine on the pinky and give it to the baby to kind of shut the baby up and ease the pain. So that was my first drunk. You know, you're in pain, a little booze, it helps. So as I said, I was born and raised in an Orthodox Jewish family. I was born in Montreal, raised there. My parents were both Eastern European Holocaust survivors. My mother had a tattoo on her arm, which was not done at a tattoo parlor. She got it in Auschwitz. And I grew up knowing where my parents came from, and how the hell she survived, I don't know. But she did. And the message I had growing up was my parents sacrificed everything for their children. They really did. That was their goal in life, was to for their kids to have a better life than they ever could. And now that bar is really low, actually, if you think about it. You know, they were both born in the 20s in Hungary. And as the stories I had heard was, you know, they were 10 kids all taking a bath in the same bathwater. And, you know, the oldest starting, and by the time the youngest got there, it was not pretty. And they had outhouses. I mean, it was really, really so different than anything that I knew. I have two older sisters. They were both born in Israel. So after the war, my parents eventually end up in Palestine, which then became the state of Israel, and my sisters were born there. And in 1960, they moved to Canada, to Montreal, for a better life. They sent me to what's called a yeshiva, which is a parochial school. It was boys only, very strict. The outside world was considered just the world of sinners, you know, and they sheltered us. Television was not permitted, newspapers, magazines, I mean, radios, none of that was allowed. We did have National Geographic. I remember in school, at this, we did have a school library. And when I was pretty young, I remember going through the National Geographic looking for those pictures, you know, the pictures, yeah, African, pictures. You know those, yeah. Pictures, but they were censored. Someone had gone through and marked up all the pictures of the African women who were not dressed appropriately.
You could just remove the word appropriately.
Exactly.
I wanted to see on this podcast.
I wanted to see something, but there's nothing to see. I mean, I had that instinct. They couldn't take that from me.
Was that hard?
Yeah, it was. I did end up, you know, so through elementary school, through high school, I mean, that was my entire life. My parents were, my father was more into that than my mother, but she wanted to respect his wishes because I was the only boy. And he was, to him, it was really important that I continue the family legacy. He had a large family, and what others thought to him, what his brothers and sisters thought of him and his family was very important. So he wanted his only son to continue the carry the name and be an Orthodox Jew. And if I became a rabbi, he would have been thrilled.
Are you?
No, I do not practice today. No, I don't. I haven't in a long time, actually. The truth is, when I was in my later teens, I kind of broke out from practicing, but I did that really without my parents knowing. Mm-hmm. It was all very cloak and dagger like, you know, Superman mm-hmm. style.
You didn't want to hurt them, and you
absolutely
didn't want that life.
I did not. I wanted the life. I didn't want to hurt my parents. Right. I remember hearing over and over, you know, if you're not going to be religious, it's going to kill your father. Kill your father. That's what I kept hearing.
There must have come a point where you had a drink or something like that.
Didn't happen till I was beside. Well, from the time I was 8 days and had that drink. The next time I had any drink of significance was when I was 15. There is a Jewish holiday called Purim. It's been compared to Halloween because of the costumes. But the point there is you do the opposite of what you would do the rest of the year. And drinking is actually a big part of that. And a friend's father gave me a pint of Seagram's VO whiskey, which I drank. I drank the whole bottle. I drank it quickly. And I remember I know it sounds corny. I remember that warmth. I remember the anxieties. I was very uncomfortable. I was a goofy looking kid. I mean, goofy, really goofy. And it didn't matter. I remember being outside. It was March, probably. It was really cold in Montreal, and I'd be outside and I'm laying in the ground and making snow angels, just having a great time. And I was really enjoying that drink. That night and the next day, I was sick. I mean, I was really hungover. I didn't do hangovers well, it turns out.
But yeah, you thought it was a good idea to have another one.
Freaking amazing. It was. I didn't start drinking seriously until a few years later. I wanted to stay in line. I wanted to be in line, and I didn't want to ruffle feathers. I did get in trouble at that school when I was in 10th grade. I got caught talking to a girl. Shh, don't tell her.
Silly little bitch.
I know. So she's the girl from the equivalent of our school, but the girls' school. Mm-hmm. They had the same restrictions. And it somehow got known that I was talking to a girl, and I got called in, and there was a whole scene, a whole to-do. And I also didn't, my hair wasn't short enough. And I was a bad influence.
Was there any?
I was asked to not come back to that school.
Oh, wow. Talking to a girl?
It was that, and just my overall behavior, they thought was not conducive for the other young men at the school. I liked listening to the radio, and I was caught with one, so that got confiscated. You know, I was just an evildoer, obviously.
Where'd you go from there? Different school?
I went to another similar type school in another city. I went to Toronto. And there, they were a little more lax, but not. They took me on a probationary basis because of my ill reputation, you know, talking
to girls.
Did you graduate
from that school?
I ended up graduating from the one in Toronto. And then from there, I spent 9 months in Israel at a post high school yeshiva, where I ended up doing a lot of hashish smoking and drinking.
No military?
No, no military whatsoever.
So was there, did you get a degree in the hashish smoking?
Yeah. It was risky in retrospect because we go to the old Arab quarter in Jerusalem and we were in places we shouldn't have been, truly unsafe. Drinking age was whatever. I don't recall there actually being one. Mm-hmm. You can buy liquor anywhere. I drank a lot and I smoked a lot. There were no consequences.
Right.
Zero. But I really had a fun time partying and I got looser with being more comfortable talking to girls, doing the stuff I wanted to do that I was so restricted doing.
And you came back to the United States after that?
I came back to Canada. I was still living in Canada at the time. Came back to Canada, did go to university. I was an engineering student, accepted into an engineering program. While I was there, I smoked a lot of hash. Hash was a big deal there. It was much more easily available than marijuana.
In Montreal. Toronto, back in Montreal.
I was back home in Montreal, living at my parents' house. Say 19-ish, roughly, around there. I'm in university in Montreal.
And drinking is not significant at this stage.
It's weekend warrior stuff.
Weekend warrior and hashish.
Yes, but the hashish was more prevalent more frequently.
Okay.
To the point where school was becoming a real challenge. Well said. I was smoking a lot of hash and it was becoming almost daily. I ended up having to drop out. I never graduated from university. I did some computer courses, worked in computer programming for a number of years.
Mm-hmm.
And through that time, there was just weekend warrior stuff, a lot of drinking. And other substances, no hard drugs, like hash again.
Yeah.
No consequences, still living with my parents.
20-something.
Early 20s, 23. Ended up moving to Toronto, working there. Again, no major consequences. Just continued partying on the weekends.
Yeah. Why not?
It was working. I loved it. I loved drinking. I really did. It just felt awesome. And I did it for years.
When did it start to, not feel so awesome? Or what?
It took a long time. I did get married. I will say this. I got married to a girl that was not on the family approval list.
Right.
Exactly.
Shiksa.
She wasn't a shiksa. She was a Jewish girl. Yes, okay. That's true. A Jewish girl, but from a very non-traditional family. I was living incognito from my parents.
Total double life.
Living in Toronto, telling them I wasn't. And I married a girl and it was just a shit show. We were only married 8 or 9 months and got
Jewish
divorced.
Guilt got
totally. My mother was the masterful guilt.
It's actually the opposite, though. You weren't causing anything.
Of course not.
It was quite
It was them not accepting who I was. But it's not how I saw it then.
Yeah.
I got really drunk and sick on a number of occasions during that time. And I was given the out not to get married to this girl. And I said, for whatever reason, I insisted on going ahead and doing it anyway. And our whole marriage was just, it just wasn't going to work.
Less than a year.
Oh, yeah. Totally less than a year. Got divorced.
And, no kids.
And no kids, no properties, no lawyers involved. It was just a clean break. I got married to a girl after that, a couple of years later, that was totally on the other side of the coin and completely on the approval list.
So Shabbat dinner,
her father is a rabbi, Orthodox rabbi. I mean, my father was thrilled. I was not thrilled. I remember distinctly after getting married and getting good and drunk, thinking, what the hell have I done?
Right.
What have I done? And We had two kids. We were married for 13 years. And I drank myself out of that marriage. I know that now. Yeah. I drank myself right out of it. The drinking got pretty heavy in my late 30s. I was already married, say, 8 or 9 years. And I started hiding bottles. I'd hide a bottle in the garage, I'd hide a bottle in the drawer, just to make sure I always could sneak a drink whenever I needed to.
I've heard this story before.
I thought that I was unique. And I, although I loved scotch, I would drink vodka because there was no smell, of course. I
mean, oh.
There's no smell, nobody will know. Wrong.
Well, I can told. Smell it. I know for sure I can smell
I'm
it.
I'm told, yeah, that you can actually smell it. So I was successful. I had a business. We had great success, as Borat says. And it got to a point where I had arrived. As Bill says in Bill's story, I had arrived. We lived in a beautiful big home in a suburb of Toronto called Thornhill, in a very Jewish community. We were members of the synagogue. We were going to Shabbat. We had dinners at our house. The scotch was flowing all the time. All the time. And me and my and the other guys, there were guys that went to the high school with that got married, and we all lived in the same neighborhood. It was like a dorm, except we all had million-dollar houses. What kind of single malt did you bring? Oh, I've never tried this one. Let's see, how much was that a bottle? Ah, you don't want to know. You know, that kind of thing. And we'd get drunk every Saturday at lunch, having our big Shabbat lunch meals, and all the kids are there. It looked like it was a great life. Problem was, after the weekend, all the other guys go back to their lives. And although I am a functioning alcoholic, I'm still drinking every day. I can't wait to get home and just hit that closet in the garage where my stuff's hidden so I can park the car in the garage. It's like that the doctor in Acceptance is the Answer, where he talks about parking the car and shooting himself up.
Acceptance is the Answer. Tell us, that is a story, right?
Yeah, that's one of the stories in the big book, page 417. Acceptance is the answer to all my problems today.
It's
about the doctor injecting himself once he gets home with sedatives so he can jump into bed. So that's kind of what I was attempting to do. There it is, 417. I'm going to take a quick detour. So oftentimes we'll say to each other in recovery, say, well, 417, acceptance, you know, accepting a difficult situation. So things got interesting. At home, we ended up, my ex-wife, who was my then wife, the rabbi's daughter, was originally from the States, from the US. She had family living in Boca, two of her brothers, her mom. And we decided that the weather in Canada sucks. Let's move to Florida. I thought it was a great idea.
Actually. How old were your kids?
So this was in, say, 2004. So one of my kids was right around 9, and the other one was about 6. And they had both been going to private Jewish schools in Toronto. And we ended up moving to Boca. Bought a house on the golf course in, it's called Boca Point. Right on the golf course, right behind our house, was a tee off. Yes, that's what it's called, right?
A tee.
So I will say this, I don't play golf. I never played golf. I dislike it immensely. But I bought a house on the golf course. So truly, I know now to say, I bought a house on the golf course because I thought it sounded really impressive.
Right.
And there's a guard when you come in. We didn't have guards and stuff like that in Toronto, although we had a beautiful home. There wasn't a golf country club. So I thought it was so impressive. Mind you, all those people teeing off by my house annoyed the crap out of me, the constant sound.
Yeah.
And like Heidi had said, you know, moving to Florida, the sun and sunshine or something. I mean, I just exploded here. But the problem really
exploded here.
Oh, alcoholism
and more drugs.
Drinking. Yeah, yeah. I'm too big on the drug stuff.
Your alcohol intake exceeded what it had before.
It had, although there was a period of stoppage. Because in Toronto, before we left, let's say about within a year or so before, my drinking was starting to be very concerning to me.
Wow, that's when you
I know. Had episodes of just violent shaking, really, really nasty effects that I was, just something was wrong. And
never it occurred to you like, I might have a problem. Maybe I should get help. You know, there's a different 12-step program. So what did you do?
So I didn't know anything about a 12-step program or AA. I went to my doctor. He sent me to a psychiatrist. Psychiatrist prescribed some medication for me, something at the time I never heard of called naltrexone, which is supposed to help with the cravings. The psychiatrist sent me to a local... we have socialized medicine in Canada. So there was also a socialized local program for people with addiction that he recommended I check out. Not a treatment center or anything like that. So
but you're living in Florida.
No. This was in Toronto.
Sorry.
This was before I moved here. Okay. I'm backtracking a bit.
Oh, sorry. I apologize.
Okay. So I told my wife at the time that I wanted to go check out this thing for my drinking. And she said, what are you talking about? I said, well, you know, I drink a bit too much. She said, really? I said, you mean you never noticed? And she said, no, I mean, you drink a lot on the weekends with, you know, the guys when they come over for lunch and stuff like that, but.
I hardly see you drinking in the garage because I'm in the house.
Thank you. She was not aware of any of that going on, which I have to tell you, kind of surprises me.
Like,
she was totally not aware. She wasn't. She says it to this day. She had no idea there was a problem.
That's incredible.
Well, I was still functioning. I was still going to work. I was still bringing home the bacon.
I'm the type of woman who knows what's in every cupboard of every part of every inch of my house.
She didn't touch liquor ever. I was hiding everything. And it was very, very organized hiding too. Wow. Everything, even throwing away a bottle would never be in the garbage at home. You know that, since I'm not crazy. So I went with my wife at the time, and at the orientation, one of the things I distinctly remember they said was, this is not a 12-step program. And I looked at her and I said, what's a 12-step program? And she said, I have no idea.
And no Google to help.
And what Google?
I know. Just
Google. So we didn't know what that was. It was, you see a psychologist, you work through your problems, and then you'll drink again just fine.
Right.
Thank God. Well, this sounds like a plan. I'm down. Let's do it. And I could go. And now the whole time I was going and not drinking, because I wasn't drinking, I was smoking a little something, something every day. Because I'm not going through the day with nothing. I mean, that's not acceptable.
No.
So I did continue smoking stuff. And at least I had something going on for me at night, especially. And so when we moved here, I was very concerned about not finding anything to smoke. I don't know why I thought that. It's a ridiculous concept. So we had to move an entire house. We used one of those big, you know, moving trucks and big company. I had stuck bags and bags of pot throughout our clothes, just scattered all over the place, and prayed that, you know, when they went through U.S. Customs, the truck wasn't inspected too closely. You know, yeah, good move, Andrew. which nothing happened, and I had my stuff when I got here. And I wasn't drinking at the time. Within a few months, I was at some party, and someone passed a drink, and I said, sure, why not? I mean, they told me I'll be able to drink again, right?
There's no solution at this point.
Zero solution, nothing. The only thing I knew about AA was I heard the name in a book or a movie, but I didn't know what it was at all. So I started drinking again, and shit got bad really fast. I mean, the drunks were intense, long.
And did your wife know at this point?
Yes. I was all out in the open. You know, this guy's got a problem. There were some incidents. Some really rough times. I went to my first detox and treatment center in 2005.
Here in Florida.
We were living at that golf course place. And I went to a treatment center in West Palm called the Hanley Center.
Oh, yeah. So very familiar.
I didn't know any place. It was a family friend of a friend who offered help and took me to whatever place was open when Hurricane Wilma hit us. This was the day after Hurricane Wilma. There was no power anywhere. And he just found a place that was taking in patients. So I ended up there.
It's a great place.
I think that was divinely inspired that I should end up there. So between 2005 and 2007, which is when my sober date is in 07, I went to Hanley 5 times. I AMA'd, which means left against medical advice, mm-hmm. twice. I detoxed at a place next door to Hanley that is no longer there. It's a state-run place called CARP.
I've heard of it.
Like, it's more like a jail than anything. And I'm not deserving of such a place, of course. I mean, it's beneath
me. You live on a golf course.
Yeah, right. Well, by then I no longer live on a golf course.
But still, you've lived on a golf course.
Yes. I was, it was recommended every time I left Hanley, not AMMA, that I don't go back home, that I go to a halfway house. And I refused and said, that's not a place for me. I'm not like those people. Mm. If it doesn't say Marriott on the door, I'm not going. Schmuck. And during that 2+ year period, I got divorced, filed bankruptcy, lost everything. I mean, all gone.
And this is all gone because of your drinking.
Oh,
these
totally.
Are consequences because
Big
you...
Time.
Could not keep it together.
Could not keep it together. Just couldn't. I had caused a lot of trauma at home. I never physically hit anybody, not my kids, but emotionally it was just horrible because I wouldn't come home. They didn't know where I was.
And what was the thing that finally got you to get it? 2007.
So I will say this, during that 2-year period, I had gone to numerous AA meetings, had a gaggle of sponsors.
A gaggle?
Yeah.
Does that mean that you read the book?
I read the book. I started steps numerous times. I had been exposed by then to a lot of AA. But I never really went through the entire process, and I couldn't stand the word God. It was a big problem for me. But what finally hit, I guess you say the bottom, was October 30th of 2007. I was in an apartment. I had been living with a roommate. Lease was coming to an end. He wanted nothing to do with me anymore. I didn't know what to do. I was drinking. I would drink, unconscious, conscious drink, in and out of consciousness. And I contemplated just ending my life, which I had never done before. And I'd say it was the darkest ever period of my entire life that I could remember, where I just wanted to die. I just didn't want to live anymore. Mm-hmm. And a couple guys couldn't get in touch with me, ended up at my apartment, saw my state of my being, and they picked me up literally and threw me in a car and took me to detox for the last time at Hanley.
2007.
October 30th, 2007. That's correct. And I ended up there, showed up there saying, I don't want to live, I don't want to live. Big mistake. They put me on suicide watch. And I meant it. I really did. And the next day, I was so, I got up, I was in detox, I was medicated. Something happened. I remember thinking, it was in one of the stories where I said to myself, you know, who are you to say there is no God? Who are you? If it's, if it helps all these people I know, why not me? Why not me? Stop fighting it because you're a dead man. You're a dead man. And I haven't had a drink since.
Incredible.
Mm-hmm.
So something turned on, a light switch kind of went off.
Yeah, I had to want to die.
If you could tell your younger self something, a piece of advice, pick an age, not 8 days, but pick an age a little bit older than 8 days.
8 months, right, or 8 days.
What age would you select, and what advice would you give young Andrew?
You know, there's so much. You know, going back, for me personally, that there were many things. And going back to my younger days, you know, based on what I know now, and I didn't know the expression "to thine own self be true" and how important that was. And for me, living the lie that I lived for so long, not only did it cause so much damage to me, but to so many other people around me for so long, because the "to thine own self be true" was just not applicable. I didn't think that way at all. And that is the most important thing I think I could have known about and held true to that statement. And I cannot live for other people.
No.
I need to be respectful of other people, but I can't live for somebody else. It just doesn't work. It imploded and it caused irreparable harm in some cases.
Take time to learn that lesson, but the sooner the better.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for joining us today. It means so much.
You want to close?
Sure.
Thank you. So first, you got to say, no, go ahead. Do it.
No, you tell me.
No, I don't want to interrupt you.
You do.
No, go ahead, you go.
Thank you so much for joining us today. If you enjoyed it, please like and subscribe. Ring that bell. And there's something else that
you know, what the closing, you know, the thank you for watching. Thank you for listening. And we'll see you next time.
We'll see you next time. Thank you.